Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Nous sommes en guerre.
Es ist ernst.
The virus is spreading.
You must stay at home.
When Europe really needed an all-for-one spirit, too many initially gave an only-for-me response.
Welcome to EU Confidential. I'm Andrew Gray, Politico's EU editor in Brussels, and we hope you're staying safe and sane in these strange and difficult times. First of all, we just wanted to say thank you. Last month, we had more downloads and listens to the podcast than ever before. We know we have quite literally a captive audience at the moment, but we also know your routines are severely disrupted. The commutes, the gym sessions, or whenever else you used to listen probably aren't happening at the moment, so we very much appreciate you're still finding the time to listen. And we appreciate the feedback too to podcast@politico.eu. Thanks for the emails. Rest assured we read every one and try to reply to them all too, although that can take a bit of time. Now, coming up in this episode, you'll hear from European Commissioner for Jobs and Social Rights, Nicola Schmidt. But first, let's take the political temperature across Europe with our podcast panel. All right, I'm just going to say hi as I see you on my screen, so nobody can, so I can't be accused of any favouritism. So left to right, Matt Karnichnik in Berlin. Hi, Matt.
Guten Morgen.
In Norwich, live from Norwich. That used to be a quiz show from a very, very long time ago. Annabelle Dixon. Hi, Annabelle.
Hello.
And in Paris, Reem Montaz. Hi, Reem.
Bonjour.
I'm going to mention something here, which I have no idea if we can play in, but I don't know if anyone has seen the clip that the BBC have made from the thick of it, where the nasty Scottish spin doctor, very, very, very bad stereotype, completely atypical of what Scottish people are like, played by Peter Capaldi, Malcolm Tucker, kind of shouts about a lockdown.
Right, people, listen up. It's a lockdown right now.
And it's a very funny clip. It is also filled with expletives, as just about anything Malcolm Tucker ever said was. So I don't know how much we can play.
Right, people, nobody move, right? Nobody move. Nobody gets truncheoned in the face. This is a lockdown, right? What that means is...
I actually managed to get out and about a little bit yesterday, following all the rules and guidelines, of course. But it is a bit of a police state out there at the moment. I mean, I was in a park and there was a park ranger checking whether two women who were exercising together lived in the same household. I heard a story the other day about a guy who took his young son to a park, drove to the park with the little boy's bike, and then was then stopped by the police when he got out of the car and told that this was not an essential journey and he was fined. And so I just wonder if any of you guys have heard examples of this kind of stuff. And it is obviously, it's a pretty severe an unprecedented situation in peacetime anyway. And or at what point does a kind of backlash come where people think we've been in isolation for weeks, we don't have coronavirus, why do we keep needing to do this? What's the mood in France?
You know, this is where I think we're going to start seeing a lot of cultural differences come up and really come to the fore. You know, at the beginning in January, February, a lot of French people were saying, oh, this government is overreacting. They're doing way too much about this. They're blowing it out of proportion. And now they're saying, you didn't do enough. You're behind the curb. What is going on? You're failing completely. So in terms of sort of enforcing the lockdown, at the beginning, they had a really hard time. You could still see the first week, like these market stalls just completely teeming with people clearly not social distancing. You see the Latin in them come out. Lately, people have truly been respecting it, although we're starting to see more and more of a role for the Interior Ministry and, repression and the police in order to enforce things as they've hiked up the value of the fines that you can get. How long they're going to be able to enforce this, I really have huge doubts.
Yeah, I just wonder how much that is a deliberation at the moment. Matt, I mean, Ordnung muss sein. People in Germany like to, follow the rules and make sure there's order. But is there any kind of pushback?
I haven't seen much pushback so far, to be honest. That said, I don't think that the rules here are quite as strict as they are in some other places, or they're not being enforced to the same degree, maybe on a regional basis in Germany. I think from what I've heard anecdotally, for example, that the Bavarians are much stricter. There's been a bit of backlash down there, for example, because people in Munich like to go hiking on the weekends and, they drive down into the mountains in the southern part of Bavaria. And when they get caught doing that, with a Munich license plate, that has created some problems for some people. It is true there are these cliches about people's sort of national mentalities, and there is certainly something to that. I haven't had any problems here so far, I have to say. Although, of course, when the police see me and recognize me, then they just kind of send me on my way. I haven't found
smart people.
Well, I think the thing is, you were already on the wanted posters. You're probably one of the people who's benefited from this. They've got more important things to do now.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
The whole society's at stake. There you go. There's always an upside. Annabelle, before you jump to the lobby briefing, is there any sense of kind of pushback or people saying, I've had enough of this now? The UK imposed these things a bit later, so maybe you're a bit earlier in that journey.
I was going to say, we're probably a funny hybrid of the two, of Germany and France. People are being pretty compliant, and that could be to do with the timing. Because by the time we got to lockdown, there was a huge amount of public support for it. There was a real push for it. And there are signs that people are getting in cars and on public transport more than they should. And I don't think our rules are quite as strict as in some other countries. And there has been quite a lot of pushback against overzealous police. There was a story of a police officer who challenged someone for buying Easter eggs in their shop. Because they said it was non-essential, even though they were in the supermarket
anyway.
That was
a bold move.
Yeah,
a bold move to keep the Brits from their Easter eggs, especially those cream eggs. Surely at least cream eggs are essential. Right?
Exactly. I mean, I'm certainly feeling like that at the moment. But there definitely is a kind of push to say to the police, look, use your common sense. Let's have a go at the people who really deserve it rather than those just buying their humble Easter eggs. But I think as the death toll increases, which it looks like it's going to, sadly, in the UK, I think pretty much everyone says, the next 2 weeks are going to be pretty grim on the numbers. And dare I say it, more people know someone, have a friend of a friend or, a direct relation who's ill or who dies. I think... that's when the support for these sort of measures grow. And sort of anecdotally from colleagues in other parts of Europe, they certainly say that, there is support for the lockdown when things are really, really bad. And it feels very personal.
Yeah, I think that's you tweeted an article from the New Statesman, which I thought was very interesting about previous pandemic plans. And it seemed to me that was the difference between people sitting in a room imagining a scenario and when it is actually real and involves real people. Right. And it seemed like suddenly a lot of those provisions just went out the window because of the emotional impact that this was going to have and kind of numbers that may have been seemed acceptable in black and white and kind of planning documents suddenly just didn't seem acceptable at all. Right.
Yeah, that's right. It's fascinating. And actually, for all the criticism that the government had about its kind of early strategy and this talk of herd immunity and just sort of accepting some loss of life in some way, as you say, the reality and the sort of political mood around that and the pressure to do something beyond kind of trying to mitigate the medical impacts certainly, as you say, is very different in reality.
Okay, we'll let you jump off and we will get deep into the weeds of the European Union. Thanks, Annabelle. Talk to
enjoy.
You.
Enjoy. Thank week. You.
Cheers. Just to kind of sum up from a Brussels perspective, I was a duty editor for Politico at the weekend, and it turned out to be a very busy weekend where Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, gave an interview to DPA, the German news agency. Didn't really make many waves as far as I could see in Germany, but as part of this interview, she talked about the concept of corona bonds, some kind of joint mutual debt that would be issued by the EU or the Eurozone, which would be used to help, you know, finance the economic response to all of this. And she described it in German as a Schlagwort, which might be called a slogan or a catchphrase, and then said that there was a concept behind it and the German reservations about that concept were justified. This went down extremely badly in Italy, which, as we know, has been very hard hit by the coronavirus. And you could see things kind of snowballing to the point where suddenly the Commission had to issue a statement on Saturday night, which I think might be the first time I've ever seen that happen, promising that the EU budget would be brought into play to help with the response, and adding a note that nothing was being ruled out that was within the scope of the EU treaties. And it seemed like this whole thing had basically been done to try and placate Italy after Italian leaders voiced very strong objections to the way that Ursula von der Leyen had dealt with this. And now we see the Commission trying to get on the front foot by producing this proposal for some kind of scheme to back unemployment benefit schemes in various countries. This idea of Kurzarbeit, keeping people on kind of shorter work while just to kind of keep them on the payroll, and they're supported by the state during that time. And here we hear Ursula von der Leyen basically saying this is happening. Europe is going to help.
Europe is now coming to their support with a new initiative. It is called SURE.
When in fact this is a Commission proposal that seems like it will still have to be approved and, you know, have to go through the usual channels here in Brussels. So I just wondered what you guys made of it from a kind of Berlin and Paris perspective.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about that interview and just the way it was handled afterwards, it just shows again how ham-handed von der Leyen has been so far as Commission president. You know, people probably remember at the beginning of this whole crisis in March, she seemed kind of oblivious to what was going on in Italy and just wanted to talk about her first 100 days, as we've discussed before. And this just seems to keep happening. I think they have a real communication problem, and I think the substance of the problem is really that, you know, where is this money going to come from? I mean, it's one thing to say we're going to set up a fund of 200 billion euros for, you know, these short work schemes, but is that really going to be enough? And I think that those are questions that nobody is really answering. And this is, I think, also what is sort of enraging the Italians, because the proposals that are out there so far, where you have, you know, the other kind of main proposal that's on the table now is to use the bailout fund, the ESM, to give countries loans equaling, 2% of their GDP, which in Italy's case would be about 40 billion euros, which is not going to get them very far, given that their entire economy now has effectively ground to a halt. So I think, you know, there needs to be some kind of realization of the magnitude of the problem and a real strategy for dealing with it, rather than just this patchwork solution and, you know, kind of for now relying on the ECB to keep the markets under control, because that's, I don't think, going to work forever.
Right. I think the SURE scheme that Ursula von der Leyen is talking may even be less, more like $100 billion. But whatever it is, it's not, as you say, it doesn't seem to, it may be part of the solution, but maybe not a major part. You know, I would just say on the communication front, I do think Ursula von der Leyen was trying to hedge her bets, but I do think she's given a number of interviews to German media outlets. And if you talk to German media outlets in German, using words like Schlagwort, and say that German reservations are justified, You know, I don't think you can be too surprised if that doesn't go down hugely well in other parts of the continent, which kind of brings us to Paris, Reem, because I did notice over the weekend that Emmanuel Macron at least seemed to have the smarts or the people around him for him to talk to Italian media, you know, stressing solidarity. But beyond that, where does France stand on a lot of these issues about, you know, how economic solidarity might be brought to bear?
You know, France is playing a really very interesting and actually nuanced, I think, role in all of this. Like you said, Macron spoke directly to the three top Italian papers, you know, because it's been something that's been, according to his advisors who's been working with him on this, it's been very much a very important thing for him to make sure that Italy, but also Spain, but really Italy, feel like the EU is with them, that they have the support that they need, and that this is not a repeat of the financial crisis of 2008, that they are not going to be abandoned. That being said, they have also had some pretty, dare I say, direct conversations with the Italians. You know, we saw that letter that the nine countries sent, so France, Italy, Spain, and a few others, right before the European Council meeting summit, in which they were basically making the case for a real common debt instrument, as they put it. And you will have noticed that the word corona bond did not exist. And that was a French position. And he had a conversation about that with the Italians to explain that from his perspective, it wasn't the best move to sort of crystallize the conversation and get people really stressed over one word. What he wants is for Europe, and actually, as Matt was saying, for Europe to have a real global strategic approach to this. And the other thing that really was very striking about this whole sort of weekend thing with von der Leyen is that the way they handled it seemed to me like they were, you know, deflecting and distracting by bringing in sort of the budget into play, when we know very well that the current conversation on the budget is at a complete standstill. So it just seemed to be like she made one mistake and then added to it by making it a little worse.
I think the really fatal thing on the interview, though, was the fact that it was coming from a German as well.
Yeah,
and
no doubt.
That it just seemed to confirm in everybody in Southern Europe's mind that at the end of the day, Ursula von der Leyen is a proxy for the German conservatives, and that she's going to kind of fight their corner. And that, in terms of European solidarity, is just absolutely toxic.
Yeah. No, that's it. I think if you're a German Commission president, you talk to German media in German and say German reservations are justified. You know, that's at least a questionable strategy when you are the European Commission president.
Can I just say one more thing on that, Andrew, just from the Italian approach? I think that that's also been slightly problematic in the sense that they've come out now and said, well, you know, we don't want mutualization of debt. We don't want pooling of debt here. All we want is a pooling of risk. That is, we want you to help us guarantee these loans that we need to take so that we have to pay a lower interest rate. And I think that that is an argument that is not going to get them very far, because to German ears, it's going to look like, oh, well, here are the Italians trying to pull the wool over our eyes by saying, well, we just need you to back these loans, and of course, we're going to pay them back ourselves. The kind of bigger picture here really is whether the crisis forces the Eurozone into some kind of fiscal union, which is what most economists have said has been lacking from the beginning of the euro and is kind of the fatal flaw. And this is something I think a lot of people don't understand the German position, that they are not necessarily opposed to that if there are enough controls. And this would mean by fiscal union that you would have a kind of finance minister or somebody in that role, a treasurer, and that the Eurozone itself would be able to raise tax income and issue debt and all of this type of thing. Now, so far, the Germans have rejected that because they have not gotten agreement from France and others to allow for real oversight of their budgets, which is what, you know, these governments don't want to relinquish, because it's the greatest power that any politician has is over the purse. And so what the Germans demanded during the euro crisis, and I suspect this will come up again in this debate, is that if we go down this route, we're going to need very strict controls out of Brussels or wherever overseeing these national budgets. So it's going to have to be a give and take if this kind of corona bond or whatever we want to call it is to go forward.
Right. And so I guess we're going to see whether the kind of heat of a crisis, manages to forge something that can't be forged in normal times. And I guess we'll see in the kind of weeks or months ahead. OK, we'll leave it there. Matt, Reem, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now let's hear from Nicholas Schmidt, the European Commissioner for Jobs and Social Rights. Earlier this week, he spoke with our industrial policy reporter, Paola Tama, where he broke the news that the European Commission is working on a plan to help shore up unemployment benefits across the European Union. A plan which has since been announced by Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. As you well know, the coronavirus crisis is not only impacting people's health in devastating ways, but it's also expected to have a long-lasting impact on our economies and on unemployment. As many as 25 million jobs could be lost worldwide, according to mid-March estimates from the International Labour Organization. And that number is likely to rise, according to officials. Paola starts off by asking the Commissioner what mixture of measures are needed in order to avoid long-lasting unemployment in the EU as a result of the crisis.
Well, I think we are all aware that this risk of massive mass unemployment exists. And therefore, I think most of the member states have already taken the right measures. And one of the first measures which has been taken is a short-time work mechanism. I had a meeting with the employment ministers last week, and I noticed that without perhaps a few exceptions, this scheme has been adopted everywhere. The second one is we have to prepare the recovery, and because the recovery will decide upon the fact if we will have mass unemployment and lasting mass unemployment, long-term unemployment, or if indeed we can shorten this period and bring people back to jobs very, very, very rapidly. And this is about macroeconomics. This is about managing this recovery. And that's on this the Commission has started to work.
Exactly. European leaders asked you for an action plan to come out of the crisis in a coordinated and effective way. What are some of the elements that you're likely to propose or that you're looking at as part of this action plan?
Yeah, the first thing is we have to prepare the action plan and recovery now. It's not once we have put the sanitarian crisis under control, and then we start with the action plan. The action plan starts now. And one of the elements is certainly supporting this short-time work mechanism, because if people stay in their jobs, first, it will be much easier for companies to restart production again, because if people are laid off, this will take much more time. And the last crisis is a good example for that. That's one of the first measures. Second, that's also bringing confidence in the economy. Confidence that we have overcome the crisis and the economy can really start again. And this is linked to jobs, to employment, and this is linked also to saving companies, because without companies, we won't have a recovery. And especially this applies to SMEs, because they are most in danger. SMEs have not the financial surface to survive a long time, a period like this one. So we have really to support a lot SMEs and to give them the opportunity to stay in the market.
So what are the risks? What happens if government get this wrong?
Well, I cannot assume this scenario. I hope that governments will have it right, because if they got it wrong, that would mean exactly mass unemployment, a very sluggish economy, not for some months, but for years. And therefore, we have to start acting now, and we have to continue this for a certain period in order to stabilize the economy and to give a new impetus. By the way, we also have to prepare the changes in our economy. We have talked a lot about the Green Deal. We have talked a lot about the technological changes. they are not now put to an end. They are still on the agenda, and especially also the technological changes. So working on the skills of our employees is something we should not neglect. So this is also part of an active employment policy, that people, when the recovery is there, when the changes in companies will occur, because when companies will restart working, they will also change inside and probably accelerate their digitalization. And therefore, we need to invest a lot in people's skills.
Thank you. Well, the EU on social policy has very limited scope. What are the levers at your disposal to ensure that workers are able to start working again once the health crisis is over?
Well, this commission is very much committed to the social dimension. This has been repeated again and again also by the president of the commission. So I think we keep on defending what is in the social pillar, because I think we have noticed now that this crisis in Europe is very serious, is very bad, but Europe can cope better with this kind of crisis because we have a strong and solid social system when we can compare it to other regions in the world. So we have to keep on working on social rights, social services, social protection, and especially also investing a lot in education and skills.
At the same time, though, draft laws in some Eastern European countries are suggesting that there is a risk of government peeling back hard-fought labor rights. Is this a worrying trend for you?
Well, I do not think that pulling back on social rights and working and labor rights is the right way to overcome this crisis. What we need precisely is solidarity. What we need is social dialogue to manage this crisis at the level of our member states, at the level of the European level, and certainly at the company level. So I'm a bit scared about what's happening now, that in this emergency situation, some elements can be adapted in a context of social negotiation, of negotiation between social partners. That is absolutely understandable. But now to roll back on social rights, on labor rights, I think that's the wrong way to get out of this crisis.
What would be the long-term consequences if governments went down that route?
Well, that would be a new divide in Europe, and that's not what we really should aim for, because what we talk a lot about economic convergence, what should not be lost out of sight. That's economic convergence, but at the same time, social convergence. So we cannot rebuild the after crisis on more social divergence. So this is something which has then to be debated inside the European Union. And this is something which would really be a dangerous approach for the cohesion of the European Union.
In terms of economic forecasts, these are pretty grim. Deutsche Bank expects the Eurozone GDP to contract by 11.4% in the second quarter of this year. There are fears that a new economic crisis of the proportions of the Great Depression might be looming. Some governments may respond by arguing that the labor market needs to be as flexible as possible to be able to ensure a rebound. How would you answer that?
Well, I'm not convinced that flexibility alone will help us to improve the labor market once we are getting out of this deep crisis. I think what we have to do is prepare our labor force for the new, for the after crisis. And there will be a lot of changes in our economy. There is an awareness now that Europe needs to rebuild a stronger industry. There is an awareness that we need skilled people. There is an awareness that we have to review our social services. I think we have all discovered that the lack of sufficient investments in our health systems was not a very good, finally, a good approach, that we have suffered from this lack of investment. So I think we have to rebuild a lot of things, and this cannot be just done by rolling back social rights, labor rights, and by the obsession of having more flexible labor markets.
Trade unions are calling for EU-wide unemployment reinsurance. One option for it is to be financed by EU debt. Is the Commission willing to look into it?
Well, we are working on an emergency unemployment mechanism or reinsurance mechanism. We are working very hard on it, and I hope that we can come up with a proposal soon. I know that the president of the Commission is very much committed to it too. So we are working on it, and I think we have to bring up some instrument first, because we are absolutely convinced that this unemployment or short-time work is essential, that we have to show some solidarity or better solidarity in this context, and therefore this instrument is needed.
How would such an instrument be financed, and when do you expect that this could actually be put in place?
How it will be financed, we are, as I told you, we are working on that. This is probably the most difficult aspect, but I think solutions are within reach. And when I say when, as soon as possible, because when I look at the figures, I see that unemployment is surging, and also the numbers of people who are in short time or technical unemployment are really exploding. So I think such an instrument is really needed.
Would you be personally in favor of EU debt insurance to pursue such a policy?
Well, I think what we need in this context, in this policy, is some basic solidarity between member states. And I would say it very, very bluntly. It would be an illusion to think that some countries will have a fast and strong recovery, and some others in the European Union would just lag even more behind than they did before. Europe will come out of this health crisis, but also social and economic crisis together, or we will enter a more difficult period, which at the end will be detrimental to everybody. So solidarity is the word we should put into concrete political action.
At the beginning of the year, the Commission launched works for a European minimum wage proposal. Is such a project going to be forced to take the back of the queue, given more pressing concerns today?
Well, certainly we are very much focused now on all the issues we have discussed now, but we will not give up this idea. This is still an issue which has to be pursued. So we continue working on that, and we certainly will make proposals to the social partners, because we should normally enter the second phase of consultation, and I'm still confident that we can do that.
How do you rate the EU's overall response to this crisis, and what could have happened earlier or better?
You know, you always can say this would could have happened better, or this. I think we have to be really action oriented. We have to see what good solutions can be implemented now. We should not lose any time. That's the case, for instance, on this unemployment or short-term emergency scheme. Now I think we have to look forward and prepare the end of this crisis and prepare a successful recovery. That's what we should do. And after we will have time to analyze what could have been done better. I think a lot of good measures have been taken. Now, they could have been taken a week earlier, but nobody at the end was aware of the strong or immense impact of this health crisis. I think it took us some time before we really understood what was going on. And once we had understood it, I think the reactions and our actions were quite good.
Thank you so much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
European Commissioner Nicola Schmidt talking to Paula Tama. And that's all we have time for on this episode of EU Confidential. We'll be back on Monday with another special episode focusing on Europe's response to the coronavirus crisis. In the meantime, we encourage you to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And also, please take a minute to rate us by clicking some stars and leaving a review. If you have ideas for topics or guests, don't hesitate to get in touch. The email address is podcast@politico.eu. I'm Andrew Gray in Brussels. Thanks to our producer, Christina Gonzalez, and thanks to you for listening.